Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is
the One World Observatory.
Observatory is straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
I basically just think it would be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing, in rap especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today, we're going to bring you two terrific actors and one actor/comedian, three people who have helped to make some of the defining TV shows of our time, all in conversations from this past fall's New Yorker Festival. We'll hear Tracy Ellis Ross from Black-ish and John Hamm on how to get your life back after a role like Don Draper on Mad Men. And when I went out on stage to introduce this guest, though, I was almost at a loss for words, as you'll hear, because this guy, if you'll excuse the cliche, it happens to be accurate, needs no introduction at all.
Welcome to the New Yorker Festival. I'm David Remnick. You know who that is. That's Jerry Seinfeld. And no flash photography, no recording.
Why not?
You want him to flash away?
Yeah, go ahead. What's
all right, you feel like Jackie Kennedy or something?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
All right, get it out of your system now. So you've got this new special on Netflix, Jerry Before Seinfeld, and one of the amazing confessional parts of it is that you begin talking about the construction of a joke, your first joke.
Mm-hmm.
What made you think you could do this thing, be a comedian, just from being funny in the house?
The truth is I really didn't think that I could. And I didn't really care whether I could or I couldn't. I just got to this point where I was so in love with it that I just decided, what's the difference? You know, what's the difference? It seemed much more important to me to do the thing you want to do than success or failure. This was 1975, you know, and it was still a little bit of the vapors of the 60s, where you did what, you know, you believed in. And it wasn't a success culture. It was a more of a soul culture, I think.
And you were encouraged to be like that by your parents?
No. I really didn't have any idea if I could do it.
What inspired you about comedy? What were you watching on television or listening to?
Everything. Everything. I was not a very social kid. But I did get a TV in my room. When my parents got a new TV, I got them to get me the old TV.
You got a TV in your room?
Yeah, I had a TV in my room, and I never came out of the room again. And I and I just watched Laugh-In and movies and Get Smart, and I just inhaled this stuff, and I just couldn't get enough of it.
Did you listen to records, too?
Records. I had all the comedy albums of all the great 60s comics.
So was there anybody in particular of all those albums that you're putting on your record player or watching on TV that was the most suggestive to you about what's
George
happening?
Carlin, AM and FM. That was when he made his transition. Wow, very educated audience we have here. That was when he made his transition from suit and tie, kind of crowd-pleasing comedian to the counterculture tie-dyed t-shirt comedian. Which, by the way, to me, the only difference was the clothes.
He was just as radical in a tie.
No, he wasn't. But he was just as funny. See, the political aspect of comedy, which people for some reason like to grind on. Why don't you do more political things? And this is political. This guy's not political. Who cares if someone's political? All I care about is how funny is this guy? How much funny, really funny stuff does he have or she have that's going to make me laugh? That is the entire objective to me. So anyway, so like George Carlin's famous 7 dirty words you can't say on television. Not a funny bit, really.
No?
Just cursing.
Right.
You know?
Which you don't like.
Personally, it's right. That doesn't work for my style, no.
Why?
It takes me out of doing the more difficult things that I'm trying to do, which is to I like to invent a new way of looking at something that changes the way you look at it permanently.
Particularly language.
Particularly language, and I like to find things in language. I do a thing in that Netflix special about when you grow up on Long Island. You live on Long Island. We lived in the city, but then we lived on Long Island.
Right.
That you can't live in Long Island. You can just, it's one of those places you just stay on it. So once you hear that bit, you know, you say, well, we get on the train, even though there's nobody on the train. We're in the train, but you don't say, let's get in the train. Nobody says, come on, we'll get in the train. You say, let's get on the train.
Yeah.
So once you find something like that and really explode it like a diagram is what I try to do, then now you see it that way forever.
You talk about this first joke in the Netflix special, and let's listen to it. Let's watch.
And I only had one joke that worked, which I'm going to do for you right now. And if you ever think yourself that you might want to someday do comedy, this is not the way you do it. Don't ever say, I'm going to tell you a joke now. So I'm left-handed. Left-handed people do not like that the word left is so often associated with negative things. Two left feet, left-handed compliment. What are we having for dinner? Leftovers. You go to a party, there's nobody there. Where'd everybody go? They left. That was it. That was my first joke.
But that joke, which you poo-poo a little bit, but that joke is very in your voice as many years ago as it was. Mm-hmm. Do you have any recollection of how it was conceived, how it came about?
Well, I am left-handed, and I guess it just occurred to me that these left words are negative, and then it started with left-handed compliment. You know, you hear that.
Yep.
And then I thought, well, that's weird. Why are they putting that on us, you know? And I don't know, they left, you know.
But I even...
So that was the joke.
But the timing of it, the delay...
The rhythm of it, yes.
The delay...
The rhythm is 90% of that joke.
And how conceived is that? How mapped out is that? Or is it rehearsed?
Very mapped out. Very figured out. You know... Where'd everybody go? They left. It's a question is always a very good springboard for a joke. There's another small thing, if you really want to get technical about comedy, which I think you do.
I do.
It is true to say to the audience, I'm going to do this joke for you right now. You're really in that moment. You're in a hole right there with the audience. You've taken them out of a comedic atmosphere. And the reason I'm able to get back into it, which was a line that I had to write, which was, left-handed people do not like. That sentence freezes the audience. This is a, you're now talking about a group of people that don't like something. This just clears their mind out to what is coming. Left-handed people are a group and they don't like something? And that is actually what enables me to do the joke. And that was you know, when I put this show together, I spent many hours on these little things just because it's what I like to do. But that was the line that I needed, and that's why that thing actually works.
Because of what
left-handed people do not like. So that enables me to do, which I'm going to do for you right now. I'm going to tell you my first joke, and I'm going to do it for you right now, which I knew they would like that because, he's going to give us a little present.
So the other night I saw you at the Beacon, and it was an hour?
About an hour and 15.
How much time goes into the construction of an hour and 15-minute piece of comedy?
It's like asking God how much time goes into an oak tree. He says, I don't know, I just... I do it every day, I do it all day, I don't know. I plant a tree, it grows, eventually it's an oak tree, who the hell cares? That's all I can do, I don't know.
What were you like in high school? Were you considered a weirdo, an outsider, or...
You know what? I don't know why. It never bothered me that I was not... I had no normal social experience at all. But I didn't think I was missing anything. And even now, to this day, most of regular life doesn't interest me at all.
No. Now, your parents were both orphans.
Mm-hmm.
Did that create any unusual home life? What was that
I think
like?
It did. There was a very, what I call a benign neglect in my house. I do this a bit in the show that I was like a raccoon to my parents. I mean, you kind of know it's around, but you don't really know where it is, you know. They had no interest in any of my activities, school, grades, social life, health, safety, or education. Zero. And which was very fun and freeing, you know. And which I also mentioned in the show that I was never funny around them, ever. And so
not
when
at
I.
At the dinner table?
No, I didn't want to make adults laugh. I don't know why. I didn't know how to do it.
Was the goal, when you were a kid, did you want to be
Wait, so just to finish that, when I told them I was going to be a comedian, they went, okay, you know. do whatever you want.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Why is that amazing?
Jewish parents who just think, go be a comedian, get on the train.
Yeah, but remember, they were orphans. They didn't get married till they were in their 40s.
Huh.
Which in, you know, 1950 was, they were wild dogs themselves. They didn't fit in any normal...
How did they view, as you started to progress a little bit in the clubs, did they ever come see you?
Mm-hmm.
How did they react to it?
They liked it, you know. They. I don't remember. I was such a nervous wreck myself. It was my, you know, my gay closet moment was to tell them I'm funny. You know, you don't know this, but I'm funny.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah, and I want to live a funny lifestyle out there. You know.
But it must require to be a young comedian whose material is sketchy,
mm-hmm.
a thick skin to the point of being almost a sociopath.
Mm.
I mean,
well,
yes, adore that?
It does. It does unless you just know you can't leave this world. You just can't. So it doesn't matter how hard it is or how much pain there may be. You know you have no choice. You know you found your thing, if you're lucky in life. If you find your thing, that this is my thing. I know how to do this. I'm good at this.
I get the feeling that even though you were and have been an actor, that maybe acting is not a form that you hold in the highest esteem.
Well, that's probably true. Yeah, it's very observant of you to pick that little raisin out of my rice pudding. What I don't like, I think, is I feel the esteem to which actors are held is a bit high in our culture, a bit high. Did you write that? Did you think of that? You know. And remember, as comedians, we would go on The Tonight Show and, you know, some loser is on some stupid sitcom who stinks and that's bad. It comes out there and tells you a story about he took a vacation in Mexico and how the pipe burst. You know, and then you come out there and you've got 5 killer minutes and you get that audience rolling. Then you go back behind the curtain. Get out of here. We want to talk with this guy with his legs crossed and going, and then I did this and then I did that. And I just felt like, why is he so important? He didn't think of anything, you know, that we have.
He just pretended to be someone.
Yeah, you're an actor. Stand over here. Here's the clothes you put on. Say what we're going to say. Ready and say what we told you to say. That's acting. There's nothing wrong with it.
No.
But I just hold comedians in much higher regard. It's a much, much more difficult thing to do.
Was doing the show as satisfying as stand-up?
At that time in my career, to pull that off, to do a sitcom and make it work, and I'm not an actor or a screenwriter or an editor or I don't know casting. Larry and I, we didn't know anything. So the excitement in that moment that we were making this show work and the network didn't even want us to be making our own decisions because we had no experience until we proved to them that we knew what to do. What we knew was what's funny. We didn't know story. We didn't know character. We learned that as we went along, but we knew what was funny. So once they had confidence in it, yeah, that was exciting. But having done it, I would never want to do it again.
So how was it conceived? On the back of a napkin in a coffee shop? How did you come together and say, we've got to do this?
Larry and I, and we were not really good friends. We were just kind of acquaintances.
And he's more of a failed stand-up. He had a rougher time.
He did. He did. But whenever we would talk, it was never about anything important, and it was completely obsessive and hilarious and insane. And I thought, I want the show to sound like when Larry and I talk.
It's about a sound.
It's about sound, yeah. In the opening of the show, a lot of times Jerry and George would be discussing if you're captured by aliens and taken back to their planet, would you rather be in the zoo or the circus? You know, that is me and Larry talking. We're not talking about our families or politics or, you know, that's what we're talking about.
And you're how old when this is starting to happen?
34.
You're talking about aliens and zoos and 34.
The other great gift of comedy is you never have to leave childhood because you're rewarded for your most juvenile impulse.
You had this incredibly intense, creative period of doing the Seinfeld show. And most people, to do another show after a big hit, and it went on for nine years. The idea of doing another show, it really blows people away. Like David Chase did The Sopranos for I don't know how many seasons, mm-hmm. and he just said, I can't. It's too consuming,
right.
too exhausting. Did you figure when you came to the end of that, there's just no way?
Well, David Chase, I'm doing David Chase's job and James Gandolfini's job.
Right.
Okay, so, and I did that for 9 years. So there's absolutely no way. First of all, that experience was so, through my great good fortune, just came out so well, there was no way you would want to revisit that.
When did you know it was going to work? Right away?
No. I thought in the beginning, this might find a little cult audience somewhere in the cities and might survive that way. Never thought this was a mainstream thing that the general public would like. I thought it was too eccentric.
Too eccentric, too ethnic, too odd?
I wouldn't call it ethnic, but it was just the things, you know, being captured by aliens and zoos and circuses. I didn't think that's, you know, the biggest comedy was Alf at that time, you know? So that's what a really big comedy is.
And it was, in some way, it was the last comedy of that, anywhere approaching that quality, but that had that kind of general audience. That's just
never
going to happen again. That was the end of that.
That was the end of it, yeah.
Why did it blow up? Just because the profusion of cable television? Mm-hmm. And do you think that's unfortunate in any way?
I always think it's possible. It's possible for someone to make another show that could capture the whole country. I think it's possible. Because it just has to be that funny. You have to be just so goddamn funny that they love it. They can't get enough of it. But that's hard to do. To do that, you need all those actors. You need a perfect group of actors. And then you need 13 writers. And then you need this person running all that who's totally focused on making this whole thing work. And that's just that's a lot of relationships and a lot of little pieces of talent.
I think it's a misconception that you've fed at times that the show is about nothing. That was always the line.
I never fed this. I never promoted this. It's so stupid. Everything's about nothing. There was an article in the. It was in the Sunday Times magazine last Sunday. That writer, what was his name? Tate. Or something, and they talk about his great writing. He was a New Yorker writer. McPhee.
Oh, that guy.
McPhee,
yeah.
Okay?
I know him.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
John McPhee.
What is his name?
John McPhee.
So they're writing about this guy, and he writes for the New Yorker, and it's so fantastic that he takes these small moments of life and makes them into these interesting things. It's the same damn thing. It's stand-up comedy.
I got to say, the idea that John McPhee, Jerry Seinfeld doing the same thing, that never occurred to you.
Well, according to the article, he makes things out of ordinary life moments, observing ordinary life moments and making you see them in a different way. This is his great art. When he does it, it's an art. Because it's the goddamn New Yorker. When I do it, it's just an airline peanuts joke.
Jerry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jerry Seinfeld. He's doing a stand-up show in Louisiana and Alabama this week, and then he's in Illinois, Missouri, and all over the country through April. Coming up in a minute, Tracy Ellis Ross, who says, even the best sitcoms sometimes put women in a box that she'd like to get out of.
Really? Am I chopping vegetables again? I'm like, look at me doing lady chores. It's really fast. I mean, I say it all the time. I'm like, can't Anthony do the lady chore?
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Oh, you tweet your neck again, huh?
Huh?
See, that's because you don't stretch. I know it looks a little gay, but it works.
What? I'm about to go upstairs and give Junior the talk.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Pops, how come you never gave me the talk?
I most certainly did. I mean, what do you think that box of condoms I left in your bedroom was about?
That was it?
Oh, you wanted a hug, too? Son, listen to me. Don't get all caught up in this having open dialogue with your kids' hoopla. It's not natural. Show me one place in the Bible where a kid talks. And for God's sakes, put some shoes on.
ABC's Black-ish has been breaking boundaries since it went on the air in 2014. In form, it's a typical family sitcom. Mom, dad, bunch of kids, friends, wacky neighbors. But in content, it's something else. It tackles the real issues that any black family in America might talk about and deal with. And even today, that's a pretty big deal for a network show in prime time. For one of the stars, Tracy Ellis Ross, the show needed to do something else too. It needed to confront some of the gender stereotypes that are more or less built into that kind of show. Ross was previously a co-star of the comedy Girlfriends, and she sat down with The New Yorker's Doreen St. Felix, a staff writer, at the New Yorker Festival in October.
So I pulled a clip, and it's from Black-ish. Mm-hmm. It's from this episode called Being Bo-Racial.
Yeah.
Season 3, you know it well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give too much of it away before we start playing it, but basically your character, Dr. Rainbow Johnson, finds out that her son has a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And Junior is a little bit of a nerd, so it could be good news, but it turns out that Rainbow has been made very upset by it for a pretty conspicuous reason.
A conspicuous reason, and also, I thought, a quite unexpected reason for the kind of woman that Bo Johnson is. Very liberal, a diehard mom, very supportive of her nerdy son, like kind of loves everything about him. So it was, I thought, a really interesting and fun reaction that gave birth to an episode and some subject matter that is not normally talked about on television.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Hey, everything okay?
Yeah, everything's great.
Okay, then why are you chopping onions like a crazy person to mask your tears?
I don't do that.
Ooh, onions. Why are you masking your tears?
Does this have anything to do with Junior's new girlfriend?
What, Junior has a girlfriend? Wow, what a twist.
Hold on, wait a minute. Is it because she's white?
Trey, you're delusional.
So you do see color.
Trey, that's not who I am.
Or is it? who you are. Please let it be who you are. Look, this is something that we could do together as we grow old.
Ew.
You know, some couples, they have golf. We can mistrust white people together. This could save our marriage. Oh, I'm getting so emotional.
So this is a very special episode of Black-ish, and I mean that in the way that term is usually applied. The first reason being that most episodes are usually told from Dre's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Dre is played by Anthony Anderson, and he's Rainbow Johnson's husband. But this is the rare episode that has Rainbow
I like narrating. The way you phrased that, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
He's Rainbow's husband. It's usually said that I'm the wife.
This is a feminist talk.
Thank you.
So in that way, I was a little bit shocked. I was like, okay, we're going to be listening to Rainbow's voice as narration. That's good. And anybody who watches Black-ish knows that the show, yes, I know we all do, it often deals with issues of identity politics. You know, there's been episodes on police brutality, the use of the N-word, class issues. But this episode feels more daring.
And one of the things I find really interesting about the show that we don't often talk about, because the show is called Black-ish, so, and it's known that we are talking about race and identity, but the womanist, feminist storyline that is going on for my character is really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is interesting for me to play is that this is not a character or a woman who is just a wife, who is just a doctor, who is just a mom. She is all of those things. And so I think this story was really interesting to me because we got to take on some of that in a very front-facing way. So the episode itself is called Being Bo-Racial, and we explore Bo's heritage and sort of what she comes from and her relationship to that. And I found it really interesting for many reasons, some of which were that her point of view is not my point of view, and nor has it been my experience. I would not have issue if my child or my brother or my sister or anyone brought home a white girlfriend. But I thought it was a really interesting doorway into this subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
It was unexpected, and I think it's one of the things our show, the writers do incredibly well, is we usually enter these very big, heavy, sticky subjects from a direction that you wouldn't expect, that you're already kind of toppled on your heels and like, wait, what's happening? You know, the fact that the N-word episode, we entered through the youngest saying it in a rap song, in a talent show.
Gold digger.
Yeah, you know, because it takes the things that have been normalized and kind of throws them on their head. And in this case, you know, that's usually Dre's point of view. That's like something that he would take on. So it was so unexpected that this mother, this the liberal feminist woman that Bo is, would have issue with such a thing. And then we get to kind of unpack that. And what we unpack, I think, is something that we don't usually unpack in our culture, sort of what it is to apparently be caught between the cultures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a mixed woman, and it's always been the most extraordinary thing to me to be a part of both cultures. There's a willingness to learn how to articulate things that otherwise I wouldn't need to articulate, how to understand, you know, like the blind spots are clearer.
But do you get frustrated portraying a character who can sometimes, out of nowhere, have a political stance that you might not have? I also read in some other interviews that the police brutality episode...
That was tough for me.
Yeah, so can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, I'm playing a character on the show. That is actually the fun of it. So the police brutality episode, my character was sort of playing the audience's point of view of like, but what if, like devil's advocate, but what if there are great cops or, I don't know, I mean, there are, obviously. But like, what if... I can't even remember, actually, but it was a point of view that was not mine. I had to keep my mouth shut, and I'm not somebody who keeps my mouth shut. But that was a really interesting opportunity for me to try something different. And the truth is that in hindsight, looking at the episode, it was a very important thing that that everything wasn't getting said. And I think that's a lot of what happens that is so well done on our show, is that we don't say everything. So we actually leave the audience and allow them the opportunity to experience, to think, to have dialogue, to question, and not everything is answered. We're not saying this is the way you should be thinking. But to answer your question, I play a character, and that is okay with me. Mm-hmm. There are challenges at times, and what it does is it makes me, as Tracy, have to go back into my world and really figure out and explore how I feel about something so I can figure out what my point of view is so that I can bring something to camera. Mm-hmm. I work very hard to make sure that my character is bringing a full life to that show, to that story and to that family, that even though the stories are told through Dre's eyes, mm-hmm. that every time I am in the story, I know what you can tell what I've been doing when I'm not in the story. Because it's really important to me that I am not wife wallpaper on that show. I don't believe that that's real. And, you know, people are like, it's so modern. Like, your character's like a doctor and a mother and a wife. It's incredible. Like, there's nothing modern about it. Like, we've been doing it forever, kids. Like, you know, so I try to bring that. Or, like, I speak up when it's things like, really? Am I chopping vegetables again? I'm like, look at me doing lady chores. It's really fast. I mean, I say it all the time. I'm like, can't Anthony do the lady chore? You know, and Anthony's always like, yeah, why can't I do? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. and I call it lady chores. Obviously, I'm joking. But because they're not lady chores. They're just things that happen around the house. So I'm very, very conscious about those things, which is a weird segue, but if I may, one of the things that was very interesting to me for how long it had been since a Black woman had been nominated in lead actress in a comedy, both for Emmys and Golden Globes, is if you look back, it's like, what are the roles that we're playing? Mm-hmm. And I believe, and I have seen Black women and women being the leads in our lives all over the place. But that being represented on television, not so much.
Especially in comedy, too. I've always felt there's such a wide gap between the Black women I know in my life.
Yes.
Who are just so funny. Like, my mom is the funniest person I've ever met in my life. Maybe second now that I've met you.
Oh, no, she can take it. She can have it. She can have it. You keep your mom right there.
But there's a way in which when we're slotted into stories on both television and film, the stereotypical space is so tight. It doesn't give you the leeway to be able to do physical comedy, maybe, or to do expressive comedy. Like you, with your face, you're so expressive on the show. And obviously, there have been many Black women in sitcoms. There's a history that we can point to. But Rainbow does feel different.
Well, I'm glad that she feels different. I would like there to be tons more of that. And not just Black women, of all colors, of all shapes, of all sizes. We women are many things. We people are many things. None of us are alike. And I think it is the responsibility of artists to really be sharing humanity and that texture and what that looks like. It's the most interesting part of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at all the different kinds of people that I'm around. And I think, though, that I'm conscious of bringing a fullness to Beau, and I'm conscious of bringing a joy to Beau. You know, even this week, Anthony and I shooting, for some reason, again, there was sort of an argumentative scene. And the director was like, if you could just try it, really sort of just like get in there. And I was like, nah, I don't always want to see that. I don't want to be the arguing wife. And although in the context of our show, that might not be the case, I'm very aware of the larger context of the images that are being portrayed and the way we're being portrayed in general on television.
I was watching a video interview of you where you're at the dinner table.
Oh, where I'm at the dinner table?
Yeah.
Okay, so when I was young, I was like this, but I didn't quite know how to wield it. It was just annoying. It was just really annoying. And, right, Rhonda? Yeah, and I also really liked to mess with her, with Rhonda, my older sister. There's five of us. Rhonda, Tracy, Chudney, and then Ross and Evan. So at the dinner table, I would like, sometimes you really hyper, like really happy. So sometimes, because it was annoying, my mom would say, why don't you just go outside and get the Wiggles out? And we had glass doors to the dining table. And so I would be like outside the door, like bouncing around and trying to make Rhonda laugh and like trying to make Chudney spit her food out or whatever it was, like bouncing around. And then I would come back in and I would sit down and my mom would be like, did you get them all out? And I'd be like, I don't think so. And I'd like have to go back out and get more out and then come back. Yeah. My grandma called it like the 8-year-old giggles, the 10-year-old, like it just kept going, and then it's clearly my career now.
But what I love about that story is it shows a real effort on your mother's part too. I'm going something
to make
with it. But to encourage who you were and to not, you know, force you to be someone that you just weren't naturally.
I think you can see my mom's parenting style mm-hmm. in all of her children because mm-hmm. you can tell we were all raised by the same lady, but we're all so different. I think from the way she parented and also who she is as a person, you know, the courage to be who you are is a part of the messaging that I got. And I have to be honest, I can't help it. I've tried to be so many other people. It just doesn't work. Like, it just makes me feel bad and, like, ashamed. And, like, I am not everybody's cup of tea. I'm just not. And that's really, I've had to learn that that's okay. Because, you know, as women and culturally, we are taught, like, you want people to like you. Like, and you want to try and fit in. And you want to try and be the should. Like, who you think you should be. I've tried to make my lips smaller, my hair smaller, my personality smaller. I think all that is I feel like I push up against all of those sort of cultural norms and all that with a sense of curiosity and like, but why? But why? Really? And with that comes a lot of grief and a lot of shame and stuff that you got to wade through when you look at the reality of what that leaves you as a human when you're on a path that is not the one that's advertised. I don't know. It can't be an accident that I'm here. I feel like... I wake up every day, as do most people, trying to do my best. You know, I don't wake up and think, I'm gonna f*** up today. That's what I'm gonna do, just see what happens. No, you wake up and you try and do your best in the time and the hours that you're given, which never seems to be enough. And then you say sorry where you can.
This was just wonderful. And we, of course, at The New Yorker, really, really, really appreciate you coming to the festival, Tracy.
This is amazing. Very exciting. Thank you. Thank you guys for coming. Thank you. Thank you.
Tracy Ellis Ross, co-star of Black-ish on ABC. We're listening to conversations from the recent New Yorker Festival. And when we come back, John Hamm. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and this is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Next week on the show, we're going to be looking long and hard at deportation in America. The government has been ramping up efforts to round up undocumented immigrants, and it's a situation that reaches into every corner of the country. We'll see what it looks like on a dairy farm in Wisconsin and at a church in Manhattan where a family has taken refuge from enforcement agents who are waiting outside. That's next week. This week, we've been listening to some of the highlights from the New Yorker Festival, where my colleague Susan Morrison recently sat down with John Hamm. Now, Mad Men has been over for more than 2 years, but it's going to take a lot longer than that for John Hamm to shake the character of Don Draper, the quintessential old-school man's man, if we can say that anymore. Draper was the strong, silent type. He's tall, dark, handsome, he keeps his secrets close, and he drinks alone. And one thing Don Draper was not too often, was funny. And for John Hamm, getting out from under all that manly baggage has meant taking parts that make fun of his Draper mystique and play up his own comic side. And here he is with The New Yorker's Susan Morrison.
Let's talk for a minute about the origin story of your comedy geekness. You lost your mother when you were 10, and
which is hilarious.
No, it's not funny, but...
See?
Yeah. And had a kind of a difficult, unconventional childhood, which led you to watch a lot of comedies.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about what
I'm kind of a weird only child hybrid. My dad was married once before my mom, and he had two daughters with his first wife, who are my half-sisters. And then he married my mom, and they got divorced when I was two. And so my mom kind of raised me till I was 10. So I was an only child-ish. And then when my mom passed away, I moved in with my dad. One of my sisters was living with him at the time. The other one had gotten married and moved out. And again, this is before the internet existed. So you had to like read books and listen to albums and cassette tapes and go to the library to figure out, to really get anything. We happened to live next to a university. They had an awesome library. So I would go to the library a lot and check out comedy records and, you know, just devour anything I could. That's where I first started reading Spy magazine. You know, that was how you consumed culture, sort of. And I was a big, I was just like, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to, I loved laughing. I loved when my dad would let me stay up late enough to watch Saturday Night Live in the 70s when I was way too young to be watching things like that. And I sought it out and kind of went and tried to find it where I could.
So what were the records? Were you listening to like Albert Brooks and Firesign Theater?
And the Monty Python, which again, that was the only way you could really see it.
Yeah.
Bob Newhart, I mean, George Carlin, Richard Pryor. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anything I could get my hands on. There's something survive. About like, yeah, I was a latchkey kid. Yeah. I would come home, I had babysitters all the time, and the one cool babysitter that I had, if my mom went out on a Saturday night, would be like, hey, can we stay up and watch Saturday Night Live? And I look back and I was like, my babysitter was like a 13-year-old boy. Yeah. It's like, what? Like, wait a minute. This guy's in charge? Different times, the 80s, 70s.
After college, you went back and you taught at your high school, which you mentioned, and you also worked in daycare, which is very sweet.
I worked at a daycare in college, and the reason I did was twofold. One, being the son of a single mom, I was in daycare basically from when I was like five on, all the time. And I loved it. It was really fun because you got to be around a bunch of other kids, so it was like I had siblings or whatever. It was like super fun and very structured, very cool. But there were no guys. There were no like male teachers. It was a very female kind of situation. And I was like, that's lame. Like there should be dude teachers too. And secondly, it was also the kind of the only job I could do in college because I had classes during the day and I had play rehearsals at night. So I couldn't be like a waiter or a bartender or anything because that was all at night. And I couldn't do anything like 9-to-5 job because I had class. So I literally had this like 3-to-6 window. And I was like, that sounds like an after school program kind of thing. And I pitched this idea to this little old lady who ran, named Pat, who ran a daycare place called Kids Depot. Not kidding.
Jesus.
It had like a little red train sign, Kids Depot. Weird, if you don't think too hard on it. It's not great. But I worked there for like 2 years and it was fantastic. And it felt nice to be able to kind of be that person that I didn't have in my life. And that's why I went back and taught at Burroughs, John Burroughs, where I went to school, is because I felt like the school had given so much to me. I wasn't in the position to write a big check and endow some scholarship, which I've done since.
Is there a John Hamm Hall now?
There isn't, but there is a scholarship endowed in my mom's name, and the first recipient of that just graduated last year, and he wants to be an actor.
Aww.
And there is a black box theater named after my first acting teacher who recently retired. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah, those are the two big things that I've done. And
So when you moved to LA after that, it took you a while to really break through, right? I mean, you were 36 when you were cast in Mad Men, and you were working before then, but it was spotty, right? What characterize that period of time for
35 when I was cast in Mad Men. I'll take her I can get at this point. I moved out to LA when I was 25. So my kind of guiding principle was, look, I don't want to be that guy who's waiting tables, losing hair, 40 years old, 3 credits on his resume, still calls himself an actor, and is just trying to hold it together.
Yeah.
I can do that anywhere. So I gave myself 5 years. I was like, a lot can happen in 5 years. And positive and negative. And that's a pretty fair amount of time to really kind of give yourself a chance to figure out the city, figure out how it all works, what's it gonna be, and really kind of give yourself a fair shot. So I was like, if I turn 30 and I don't, and I'm still, you know, kind of waiting tables or whatever, then I'll just pack it up and I'll go do something else. Right. You know, the market has spoken, so to speak. And let's not kid ourselves. Like, acting is, especially now, less so, a little bit less so then, but especially now, is a young person's game, mm-hmm. basically. And fortunately enough, I happened to turn 30 on the set of my first film that I ever did. It was called We Were Soldiers. And then literally after that, the fall after that, I got my first regular part on a series, mm-hmm. a show called The Division, which I'm sure you all watched. And there's going to be a quiz. That was on the Lifetime Television Network. About 5 lady cops and me.
Well, when Mad Men hit, when you were 35, it created a frenzy. I mean, I remember that year being in a subway car on Halloween, being surrounded by, you know, 50 drunk Jones and Dons. You know, I mean, it was just a frenzy. And there are all kinds of explanations aside from just the goodness and quality of the show about what that, you know, why it created that kind of stir. What's your theory?
First of all, there was really nothing like our show. I mean, it had its elements of things that I think people could recognize, but it stood out in a way that was very helpful in separating it from what at that point was sort of an explosion of TV. And I mean, since then, we've had an even more, a double explosion of TV. But that was kind of the first one where it was always HBO and Showtime. They were doing their prestige television. But then in 2005 or whatever, the other networks started to do cool shows and promote them as cool shows. And they were cool shows. And they got important movie stars to be in them. And ours was different. It was a show that had buzz and a show that was intelligent and it didn't talk down to its audience and it was cryptic and it was weird and it was slow and it was all these different things that people kind of didn't really know what to do with it, but they knew it was different and people talked about it, and it, I think, not for nothing, coincided with the advent of the iPhone, and with blog culture. And recap culture.
So viral.
What started to happen, our show certainly wasn't the first, but people started just writing blogs and pieces and think pieces about the show, and it had this outsized kind of cultural footprint mm-hmm. that nobody watched it, but people loved to talk about it. and I mean, that's what it was. And it was a very interesting experience to go through that, because, you know, the show sort of won awards and things out of the gate, so we knew we were a hit, mm-hmm. but there was always but no one watches it. The first season, our advertisers were like boner pills and that headache medicine that you put directly on your forehead. And season 2, it was Mercedes-Benz and Heineken. So we were like, somebody's watching, and they're really rich. So that's kind of when we realized, like, oh, wow, like, this is happening.
We have a little Mad Men clip we'll take a look at.
I hate dating. Terrible at it.
You'll find someone. You know you're cute as hell.
Men don't exactly stop and stare in the streets.
Do you want that?
It's not what you were supposed to say.
What do you care what I think?
Oh. Everybody thinks I slept with you to get the job. They joke about it. Like, it's so funny because possibility was so remote.
It's not because you aren't attractive. I have to keep rules about work. I have to. You're an attractive girl, Peggy.
Not as attractive as some of your other secretaries, I guess.
You don't want to start giving me morality lessons, do you? People do things, right?
What's Lizzie Moss been up to?
Do you feel like playing a character like Don Draper costs you anything emotionally? I mean, is it corrosive to play a terrible person convincingly?
Yes and no. I think it is hard to be in that headspace 24/7, but I'm not the kind of person that takes stuff home with them. Mm-hmm. Part of it was just taking off the suit and taking all that out of my hair. Felt, sort of redemptive in some way or cleansing in some way. And then you go home, and you live your life. But it's hard. Part of navigating what the show became and navigating the success and all that stuff is the trickiest part of it. The work is great. The work is what you want to do. It's navigating the rest of it, especially now. I don't know. I mean, maybe it wasn't as hard before there was TMZ and social media and all this other garbage, but that's the challenge.
Mad Men was just such a career-defining role. I wonder if your whole acting life post Mad Men is sort of a reaction against Mad Men.
No, I think not necessarily. The fun thing for an actor is to be able to do different stuff. And so it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to react against and play the opposite, but I definitely wanted to just do different things. And so when, for example, Tina Fey decides, okay, hey, you want to be on 30 Rock? That's different.
Yeah, I'd like to do that.
That's kind of fun. For me, the fun part of doing what I do is doing things that are a little bit risky, make you feel a little bit uncomfortable. And I've certainly been guilty of doing a lot of those things. So,
well, one of the great things about the combination of an indelible character like Don Draper and your comic skills is that you've done a lot of wonderful, what you could call comic send-ups, in a way, of the Don Draper type. I'm thinking of your role in Bridesmaids. Why don't we look at that clip?
Oh, God.
Which I love.
You slept over.
I did.
I thought we had a rule against that.
Oh.
I'm kidding.
Oh. That was funny. You're funny in the morning.
But I like hanging out with you.
Oh, yeah. I love hanging out with you. I think we get along really well, and you're so sexy. And
I know. I just have a lot coming up at work, and I don't want to make promises I can't keep. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I know you do. Yeah. We're on the same page. I mean, I'm not looking for a relationship right now either. Let's just say that. I'd rather just, I like simple, not like other girls. Where I'm like, be my boyfriend. Unless you were like, yeah. Then I'd be like, maybe. I don't want that either.
Wow, this is so awkward. I really want you to leave, but I don't know how to say
that.
So
oh.
You guys have such great chemistry together. It's really funny.
That is a very weird thing to say about that scene.
I mean, comic chemistry. Now, was this before or after you and Kristen Wiig did a lot of great stuff together on Saturday Night Live?
It was after. Kristen and I knew each other fairly well by this point, and she had come to me and said, Annie and I wrote this great movie, and we're really excited. We really want you to be in it. And I was like, cool. I was like, I'm kind of doing this show. I don't have a ton of time. And she's like, we wrote a part for you. And I was like, I read it. And I was like, the first three pages are like, we're just like, it's a big sex scene. I was like, Kristen.
Now, Tina Fey is famous for saying once that John Hamm was so handsome that she wanted to poke a hole through a paper plate and look at him through it like she was looking at an eclipse.
She actually said that in front of me, too. And I was
she
like,
did?
What is wrong with you? I'm right here. How
so,
dare you?
Thank you all. Thank you all for coming, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Putting on the suit and
it's so late.
And everything else.
John Hamm at the New Yorker Festival in October 2017 with the New Yorker's Susan Morrison. Thanks for listening today, and if you haven't been to our website lately, please visit us at newyorkerradio.org. We've just got a redesign for the new year, and if we do say so ourselves, it looks pretty good. Every episode, every segment we've ever broadcast is there, and you can subscribe to our podcast so you never miss a thing. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with special help from the staff of The New Yorker Festival, Rhonda Sherman, Alexis Goldberg, David Ohana, Bradley G., and Hillary Leichter Griffin. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.